From Entrepreneur Media, this is Problem Solvers, a show in which entrepreneurs do what entrepreneurs do best, solve unexpected problems in their business.
We were completely wrong.
And I'm just like, it's not selling.
It was like, we have to start from scratch.
I'm Jason Pfeiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. Hey, listeners, before we get to this episode of Problem Solvers, here is a word from our sponsor. I had this frustrating, like insane problem. My personal website is built on one platform and my personal newsletter uses another platform. So whenever someone used the native signup form on my site, I would get an email about it and then would have to manually input this new person's email address into my newsletter platform. And oh, this was time consuming. But you know what solved it? Zapier, because that's the kind of thing Zapier does. Zapier is the easiest way to automate your work. We all use lots of different apps and pieces of software, and Zapier enables them to work together seamlessly. For example, Zapier lets you instantly engage with leads, then send them to a CRM or spreadsheet, then notify your team so that they can act fast on every opportunity. Zapier supports more than 1,500 business applications, so the possibilities are virtually endless. The point is, it handles all the nitty-gritty so you can focus on the work that matters. And right now, through November, try Zapier free by going to our special link, zapier.com/problem solvers. That's zapier.com/problem solvers for your free 14-day trial. zapier.com/problem solvers. And now, on with the show. How much experience do you think it would take to become totally fearless? What do you think you'd have to do to become the kind of person who just says to themselves, you know what? I can do anything. I don't know. How about, like, let's say you've run hedge funds and investment funds. You've founded like 20 companies, made a fortune, written tons of books, been on national TV countless times. I don't know. You think that would prepare you for anything? Well, it doesn't.
There wouldn't be a single time where I didn't think to myself 5 minutes beforehand, I'm just going to tell them I'm not going to go up. I'm not feeling well and just leave. Because I was terrified, terrified.
That is James Altucher. And I basically just told you his bio. He has one of the most varied, impressive, crazy careers of anyone I've ever had the pleasure of getting to know. And he has a great podcast called The James Altucher Show. But one of the things that he does now a ton, and this is what he was referring to right there, stand-up comedy. The guy got into stand-up comedy, and I don't mean he just like kind of got into it like a little bit of a hobby. He does it 4 to 5 times a week. He invested in a stand-up comedy club, and the most times that he has done stand-up comedy in 1 week, 12 times. 12 times. And you might wonder, why does somebody do this? And the answer is, well, it's a long, complicated answer, but one of the most important answers, I think, is James felt like there was something in stand-up comedy, something important that could help him off the stage. And you know what? He didn't even know how. He just knew if he got up there, it would be valuable.
Yeah, I think I rationalize that learning this skill that has no other benefit in my life on the surface will actually have great benefit in my life. I rationalize that, but then it actually turns out to be true.
I have this belief, it's how I've basically operated my career, which is that you should do things without knowing the ROI on them. You just do something new because you know that you're adding value to yourself, that you're making yourself more versatile, more able. I mean, the reason that I'm able to make a podcast that you're listening to right now is because years ago I decided, you know what, I'm going to get into podcasting. I don't know if it's going to make me any money. I don't know if it's going to be valuable. I'm just going to start doing it. I started doing it in my bedroom. And now here it is. I actually make nice money off of podcasting. And I make one for Entrepreneur here that you're listening to right now. And that's been really great for our brand. Anyway, the point is that I started to do something and it was strange and foreign and took a lot of time. But I did it because I didn't want to focus on the ROI. I wanted to focus on the skill, just knowing that somehow this would pay off in a way I couldn't have even anticipated later. And that is something that James does over and over again. But today on this show, I wanted to dive deep into why he does stand-up comedy. I mean, stand-up comedy is challenging. It is, I wouldn't do it, frankly. It just sounds really scary. And he has gone through the ringer on it, but he is also committed in a way that I rarely see somebody commit. So how do you get to the point where you are afraid of doing stand-up comedy, and yet you push yourself to do it up to 12 times a week, not even knowing exactly how this thing is going to pay off. That is what we're going to talk about today. And we get into fascinating things about how to embrace new things, how to push yourself out of your comfort zone, and how to find value in something that seems, well, just kind of crazy. It's going to be my conversation with James Altucher coming up after the break. A Master of Business Administration is the graduate degree of leaders and is an incubator for acquiring the business skills you may never otherwise gain. And the best thing is, you don't need to take 2 years off of your game to earn one. The University of Utah David Eccles School of Business MBA online program is an internationally accredited online MBA that ranks top 10 in the U.S., but costs 30% less than other comparably ranked programs. Utah's MBA Online features cutting-edge, on-demand curriculum and weekly live web conferencing led by world-renowned faculty thought leaders. Learn with other experienced high-level professionals, executives, and entrepreneurs from around the world and complete your MBA online anytime, anywhere in as little as 24 months. To learn more and receive an application fee waiver, visit utahmbaonline.com/problem solvers. Again, that's utahmbaonline.com/problem solvers. And now, our next sponsor. Entrepreneurs know better than anyone. If you want to make something happen, you have to build awareness. Awareness of your brand or your product or just the importance of the world you operate in. And that, I suspect, is why National Life Insurance Awareness Month was created. That's what September is. And it's aimed at the 40% of Americans who don't have life insurance, perhaps because they think it's too difficult or expensive to get. But you know what? It's not. Policy Genius is the easy way to shop for life insurance online. In minutes, you can compare quotes from top insurers to find your best price. Once you apply, the Policy Genius team will handle all the paperwork and red tape, and they'll help with home, auto, and disability insurance as well. So, if you need life insurance, National Life Insurance Awareness Month is a pretty strong time to get started. Just go to policygenius.com, get quotes, and apply in minutes. You can do the whole thing on your phone right now. Policy Genius, the easy way to compare and buy life insurance. All right, we're back. So as you know, Problem Solvers is generally not just a conversation show, but I wanted to talk to James about stand-up comedy, and he invited me to do so at Stand Up New York, the comedy club in which he's invested in. They have a really nice podcast studio, and we sat down and just had what ended up being a kind of far-ranging conversation on this subject of pushing boundaries and getting involved in things that you're afraid of and how the unexpected can really expand your mind and career. And it was so full of wisdom that I want to share the whole thing with you. So here's how we started. I asked James to explain to me, how on earth did a guy who has had so much success in business ever get into his head that he wanted to be a stand-up comic?
In 1996, I was working for HBO, and part of my job was spread throughout HBO. It wasn't in one department. And part of it was I was working for HBO comedy, and HBO was the premier television network for comedy, basically. Like, that was the only network where, and Comedy Central too, where comedians could really break out. And for instance, we would host the Aspen Comedy Festival. So I would go there. I would do websites about all the comedians. I would interview all the comedians. We're doing this interview in a comedy club. I interviewed Rodney Dangerfield. I interviewed George Carlin, wherever he is, if he's up here.
Right, we're looking at albums that are posted on the wall here.
And then in New York, I would go to every stand-up comedy club all over town almost every day. And I really wanted to do stand-up comedy then. I was obsessed. I wanted to do it, but I was terrified. It was only 4 years ago, 5 years ago, that I've done 20 years of public speaking where everyone's laughing in when I give talks, that I decided to do stand-up comedy, and it was so fundamentally different from public speaking. It was a completely different art form, and it's probably, I love skill acquisition. It's probably the hardest skill I've ever had to learn, and that includes investing, entrepreneurship, writing, even chess, poker, other things I've been obsessed with in the past.
So you just jumped a ton of career there, and we're not going to dive into that whole thing, but just to sort of make the point, so you were at HBO, you were around comedy, it appealed to you, but then you went in a different direction. You were in hedge funds for a long time, you became a writer, you were an investor.
So what was it about 4 or 5 years ago? You had developed a skill set of speaking, so the stage itself was not scary, but something must have happened. And I'm wondering what it was where you said, okay, it is time to now stand on a stage and not give a talk, which is something that you're comfortable doing, but to tell jokes to an audience that has a very different expectation than the other audience you've ever spoken to. Do you remember that first time, or rather, even more importantly, the first time you thought, okay, I'm going to do this?
So in January 2014, I had to give a talk, and Paul Reiser, the comedian, was giving a talk immediately, or doing an act immediately after me. So I figured, okay, I'm going to try to structure my talk as stand-up. And in stand-up terms, I killed, like I did very well. And people came up to me and said, oh, you know, it seemed like you've been doing stand-up comedy as long as this other person. And then about a year later, Stephen Dubner, who wrote Freakonomics, he and I were doing a podcast together, and we challenged each other to do stand-up comedy. So we rented out the Bell House in Brooklyn, sold a bunch of tickets, and we both did stand-up for about 10 minutes. And I was thinking, even while I was doing this, I could do this every day forever. Like, I just love it. And then I started, I knew Donnie Zolden, who owns Stand Up New York, or who owned Stand Up New York. Now I co-own it with him. He said, why don't you perform on stage here? And I did. And I just got addicted to it. Like, it was so gratifying to make the audience laugh, an audience of strangers. And I recognize this is a skill set I want to learn. It's a very extremely difficult skill set.
Yeah. So what
and
is
I love
it?
Learning new skills.
Yeah. So, well, I want to take both of those, right? Because actually, let's talk about learning new skills before we talk about this particular skill set. I think that this is a desire inherent in entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs are learners. They're lifelong learners. What is it for you about developing a new skill that you feel like is important and gratifying?
Well, you have to love it. Like, so first off, you have to love what you're doing. So if someone said to me, James, I really want you to apply your techniques of learning to golf, I wouldn't do it. I hate golf. But if there's something that starts to, you feel inside of yourself, you do something and it lights a little bit fire, like, oh, I would like to get better at that. That seems fun. And I admire the people who are good at this. I'd like to be like them a little bit more.
Do you think it's just that itch that you want to, the thing that has probably propelled, I'm going to propose a theory here. The thing that has propelled you through your career is that when you identify something that you really find interesting or gratifying, you dive into it in the pursuit of mastery.
Yes. And to the detriment of almost everything else in my life. So if you were to say a number between 6 and 51, I'm 51 now, I can tell you exactly what I was obsessed with at that age and everything else.
39.
Okay, 39, I was still interested in, well, actually I was starting a company, Stock Picker, and I was obsessed with entrepreneurship again. So I said different periods of my life, I've been obsessed with entrepreneurship. 38, it was more investing I was obsessed with, and 37 and so on. But you do something and I get like, oh my gosh, this is great. And then the interesting thing about skill acquisition is that most skills worth doing are not skills. So there's no skill such as entrepreneurship. It's really a collection of skills, what I call micro skills. It's negotiating, it's sales, it's leadership, it's motivation, it's coming up with ideas, it's execution, it's raising money, it's selling a company. Investing is not just one skill. It's value investing, growth investing, risk management, understanding the history of investing. Like, there's a lot of different skills. Writing is about plot, various literary devices, dialogue, storytelling versus.
So what you've done is you've programmed yourself, or rather you just were programmed to have the habit to collect skills because you knew that they were valuable in their completeness, that to really accomplish something, to be good at something, you need to acquire lots of different skills that will combine into some kind of greatness. And so what defines someone who's successful, I think, is, and I again, put this as a theory for you to respond to, is that they've programmed themselves to acquire new skills constantly because they know that it will be valuable, not just for the individual skill, but in its completeness. That when you add a new skill to your arsenal, you just become better at everything. And sometimes that will lead you down weird paths. So sometimes you'll just want to be really good at developing a plot. That's a very specific skill set because you want to be a writer. But then other times, maybe it just leads you down comedy because it scratches some kind of itch. You have developed this habit of skill acquisition, and you know that doing this will be beneficial in some way that maybe you can't even anticipate.
Yeah, I think I rationalize that learning this skill that has no other benefit in my life on the surface will actually have great benefit in my life. I rationalize that, but then it actually turns out to be true. So in some cases, it's not true. Like getting better at poker, for instance, doesn't necessarily help other areas of your life. Getting better at chess did help other areas of my life, but not because of the skills I learned, because of the way society conflates chess with intelligence.
Right, but doing both of those things kept you active in skill acquisition.
Yes, so what happens is after you learn that first, and by learn, I don't mean just learn, I mean kind of master to some extent. After you master that first skill or two, you realize, oh, there's a grammar to this. Kind of like Chomsky's universal grammar of every language. Is there something primal about learning anything? And it turns out, yes, there's the same approaches you can do again and again and again. You still have to be obsessed with it. You still have to love it. But then there's kind of like, okay, I'm in this. I'm staying in this. I'm going to do what I normally do. And that's whether it's, again, computer programming, poker, entrepreneurship, whatever. So I did that with comedy is I began that approach and I found other comedians don't do that approach necessarily. So it allowed me to, I could measure my success by, as much as comparison is the thief of joy, I could measure my success by seeing where I am vis-a-vis other comedians in the hierarchy. Every skill has a hierarchy from best to worst. And so I can kind of see how I'm skipping the line and how I'm learning and what things I'm learning, and what things I need to learn, what things I don't want to learn. But yeah, you find that learning or mastering maybe two skills, you start to see, okay, this is how to learn to learn.
What was the first big skill you had to learn once you started doing stand-up comedy?
It's interesting because most people would say humor. In fact, people say to me, why are you doing this? You're already a funny guy. Why do you need to do stand-up? And humor is maybe the third most important skill for a stand-up comedian. I think likability is very important. That might be the first.
Yeah.
The second might be stage presence. Because, and you would think after 20 years of public speaking, you have stage presence, which is true for a public speaker, but it is 10x for a stand-up comedian. So this is where I could say learning comedy does help in other areas. A basic example being when I take my comedy skills back to public speaking. Now, even though I was already humorous as a public speaker and I had stage presence and all these things, it's just 10x what you have to learn to be good at stand-up comedy compared to public speaking. So there's likability, there's stage presence, there's humor writing,
yeah.
Okay, which is difficult in a stand-up comedy format because you have to strip out every word that's useless. And then there's crowd work. I could go on.
Yeah, sure. So let me go back to the first two because it must have been jarring to stand on stage the first couple times or however many times. And we should note, by the way, you've told me this off mic, but we haven't said it on mic. You're doing stand-up. You are not just kind of dabbling in it. You committed to this on an almost nightly basis, correct?
Yeah, I would say the most I've ever done it in 1 week is probably a dozen times. And like this week is an example, I'll do it 4 or 5 times this week.
Okay, which is a lot.
Yeah.
So
I feel very blessed because somebody doing it as many years as I've been doing it doesn't usually get a chance even to do it on a professional lineup to a real audience, not an open mic audience, this many times
right,
a week.
Sure. Yeah, right. I mean, you watch Crashing on HBO, the Pete Holmes character is like struggling to get on stage at all. So to be able to do this regularly and really hone your craft is super fortunate. So this is something that's always been jarring for me, is feeling like I was good at something and then putting that skill into a different context and discovering that I'm actually not as good at it as I thought I was. And
what's an example?
Well, writing magazine stories earlier in my career where I had gotten really good at one kind of writing. I was a newspaper reporter. That's how I started out. And then I got a job at Men's Health. And Men's Health is a completely different kind of writing. You're not really reporting. You're doing service journalism, which is you're finding information. You're discovering how to make it useful to your audience.
You have to tell more of the arc of the hero in every article.
No, actually, not necessarily, because you're often in service journalism, you're often not telling at all. That comes more naturally to me because I learn what's going on in somebody's life and then I figure out the narrative and then I figure out how to tell it. Service journalism is that you go and gather a lot of information. You figure out what part of it is most useful to your audience and then you rearrange it in a prescriptive way. And so you say, if you want to lose weight, you should do this, 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 and this, right? Which is different from saying, here's how this person lost weight. And first they struggled and then they were able to accomplish it, right? And then they have the hero's journey. And that part didn't come naturally to me at all. And so I really struggled at first when I got that job to use the skill set that I thought I had in a completely different context. I felt like I totally sucked at that job for a while. And then it clicked. It clicked after a while because I started to understand who my audience was and what I was to them. I wasn't a reporter to them. I was a guide to them. So my job was different.
Oh, that's really interesting. I'm going to have to check out the differences between, I have never read Men's Health. I'll have to read some articles there and see what that means.
Yeah, it's impressive in its diligence. It is on a sentence by sentence level, very focused on servicing a reader in a way in which you just don't do when you're just telling a story. It's the difference between implicit and explicit service, right? So like, you might write a story about somebody and you want people to learn from it, but it's really about that person. And so that's implicit service, right? There's some like service built into it. Service meaning advice. And yet explicit service is rearranging all the information so that I am saying, you do this. This is how you can be better. And that's different. It's a different kind of writing. It's a different kind of pacing. It does not come naturally. But I found that getting better, and this goes right to your talk about comedy, getting better at service journalism made me a better writer in every other format.
That's interesting because, so like in the early 90s, I was obsessed with fiction writing and never published a novel, but I thought with anything you start, you think you're better than you are. So I just wrote obsessively. I wrote 3,000 words a day for about 4 or 5 years. And I wrote 4 novels, dozens of short stories. Again, never published a single thing out of them. But doing that skill and then also reading a lot made me just a better writer in general when I started writing about finance and then when I started writing more self-help type of stuff. That kind of allowed me to skip the line in some sense on writing just because I had this extra writing skill.
Yeah, which is why, I mean, to our earlier conversation about developing skill sets, which is why I've always found it really important to do things without really understanding what the ROI is on it. Like if you know the direct path, then there's probably a limited application. But if you do something just because it fascinates you, you will broaden your own abilities in ways that you won't be able to anticipate, but that will probably be really useful in ways that will surprise and delight and make you better.
Yeah, it's been a fascinating experience because almost every skill I've tried to learn in the past probably would take between 1 and 2 years before I felt like, okay, I'm at the level I want to be at. Comedy now is 4 or 5 years going on. And if I count from that 2014 point, it's even longer, but it's the longest I've tried to get good at a skill and still not feel I'm at the level I want to be at.
Yeah.
And writing probably took like 3 years.
This also reminds me, and I'll tell you my experience here as a way to segue back into your experience. Another thing, a thing that I challenged myself recently on was that I had become good on video, felt like I had become a good talker. I knew the mechanics of being on television, but I didn't really know how to freestyle on subjects that I didn't feel like I was a master of. So if you brought me onto a TV show to talk about an article that I had written, I could nail it, right? Or come on to talk about a subject that I always talked about, no problem. But if you brought me on to talk about the day's news, and I'm not a news reporter, and therefore I don't feel a mastery of that, I got scared because I didn't know where to go with it and I wasn't comfortable with it. So I started going on Cheddar, you know, Cheddar.
Yeah.
I started going on Cheddar like weekly to biweekly. This was a couple of years ago. And the reason was because I wanted to get better and better and better on coming on and talking about a subject as if I am an expert, but I am not an expert.
I think that's it's fascinating that you recognize that in yourself. And B, it's a great thing that you then force yourself to do something challenging, but very much in the public eye to force yourself to get better. That is an important technique.
Right. But it wasn't fully in the public eye because I wasn't doing this on Good Morning America. I was doing it on Cheddar, which I knew had a smaller audience and was probably going to disappear into the world. And so if I sucked, the risk wasn't that high, which is also why in comedy, you started a small club, you don't like get up at the Apollo and do bad stand-up, right?
True. But if let's say you're going up in front of a room full of like 12 strangers, let's say on a bad night, there's 12 drunk strangers there. Right. When I first was starting to do it, I was so terrified. There wouldn't be a single time where I didn't think to myself 5 minutes beforehand, I'm just going to tell them I'm not going to go up. I'm not feeling well and just leave. Because I was terrified, terrified. And even now, like last night, I get so nervous beforehand. I assume I'm just going to bomb. I'm going to lose. I'm going to be disappointed. I'm going to get depressed. And this is after going up like over 1,000 times now.
I love that you felt that way and that you talk about it. And then I'm curious about the architecture that you create for yourself to get through it. So for example, with me and Cheddar, what I did was they'd tell me the subject ahead of time, but only like a day ahead of time or sometimes that morning. And I would research the hell out of it and I would come up with like 6 talking points and I would write them down and I would kind of memorize them so that I knew where to go. And then my goal, that was the starting point. My goal was every time that I do this to become looser and looser, to take my hands more and more off the steering wheel to the point where, okay, I'll write the notes, but I won't like try to memorize them. To I will just read the stories and not write any notes at all. To I'll just show up in the studio and come up with stuff. And I did that. It took a long time. It took like 2 years to do that, but it got me, it pushed me to become more and more fluid and comfortable in knowing that I could just talk like an expert without necessarily having to be an expert, which is actually the job of somebody who's a pundit on television.
Well, and what's interesting what you did there is you kind of isolated something you wanted to get good at and you figured out how to isolate it without the distraction of other things. Like, can I talk freely about a topic I might not be an expert on in a public forum that people are going to judge me
in
on?
In a confident,
right,
expert-looking way.
So you isolated that as opposed to other things you could isolate. You didn't say, I'm going to become an expert on this topic. Maybe you were, but again, you're isolating one important part of the skill set that you felt you weren't good at and you worked on that. And I think like I had a similar experience with TV. The first time I was on CNBC in 2003, I again was terrified and so terrified I was going to lose my mind in terror. And they gave me a set of questions beforehand. And I said, specifically, don't ask me this one question. I know nothing about this one question. First question asked was that question. It was Larry Kudlow, who's now our nation's economic advisor or whatever. And he asked some question about gold. I had no interest in gold. I didn't talk about it. I never read about it. And I had to answer like that. And I did it. And it was fine. But I don't think I got good at going on TV until like 2 or 3 years into it.
There is a phrase that I heard recently, which is problem-solving space, operating in a problem-solving space, where you can visualize the space and see how to solve the problem. And I've come to do that in those moments where if somebody's posing a question to me, the very first thing I do is I almost imagine it like a maze. And there are ways to get trapped in the maze, and then there's a way out of the maze, which is to say this other thing or to find this one element of their question that can help me pivot into something else where it seems like I'm answering their question, but I'm immediately moving into a space where I'm more comfortable. And so it doesn't look like I'm fleeing, but at the same time, I'm solving the immediate problem. And it's almost become a visual, physical space for me. And then I heard somebody use the phrase problem-solving space, and it clicked.
Well, it's interesting because the problem-solving space in what you're describing, there's also in media training, there's something called what's your media message? So you come up with 3 points that's important to you. And so no matter what they ask, you pivot into one of those 3 points. So you could see this like with Barack Obama when he was pushing his Obamacare. If someone said, well, what are you going to do about crime in the cities? You would say crime in the cities is a huge problem in the U.S. and it's going to be much better as everybody gets better healthcare. So there's also a technique where you pivot into the 3 things that are important to you.
So let's go back to you're going on stage and you're terrified. You had some skill sets, but you're discovering very quickly that they don't necessarily apply to being good at this thing. So what was your architecture?
None of them applied. Not a single skill set I thought I had applied.
So what was your architecture or coping mechanisms or strategies? How did you get through it?
I think what I did was I isolated the micro skills. Like I started with that list of 3 things I mentioned before, but there's probably about 15 micro skills. I started watching hundreds, maybe thousands of videos of stand-ups I admired doing stand-up comedy. I would mimic them literally in the mirror. Like I would mimic a Dave Chappelle, mimic a Louis C.K., do their voices. I would have video taken of my own performances and I would study them later, like, oh, I'm hunched forward too much, or I'm not breathing while I'm talking. I'm talking over the people laughing. So if I got someone to laugh, I'd be so afraid of slowing down. I would talk, start the next joke while people were laughing. Yeah. So I would analyze the videos. And then I was fortunate to have a podcast. So I would have tons of comedians that I admired on the podcast. And they would think, oh, I'm asking them about their careers. But I would really also every now and then throw in something, well, what if this XYZ situation happened to you? What would you do? And it was a situation that happened to me last night. And they would tell me, so I learned, and I had this. It's a great benefit to have the best in the world give you advice about very specific situations. And there's a framework I write about in one of my books, Plus Minus Equal, where you always want to learn from people better than you. You want to talk to people who are the same level as you because they're equally hungry and trying to move up. And then you want to be able to explain to people not as good as you because you want to be able to explain simply what it is that you're learning and doing and how you learned it. And you also want to see what questions they have because that might be things you forgot about. It's the fun, always getting back to the fundamentals is important. So this plus minus equal framework worked. This framework of dividing it up to micro skills, trying to isolate them as much as possible, and then working on each micro skill is very important. And then again, immersing yourself. You know, you're only on stage 5 to 15 to 20 minutes tops a couple times a week. But the other days, you want to immerse yourself in whatever ways you can. So there's plenty of books. There's comedy biographies. I just read a memoir by Joan Rivers, which was amazing. I watch comedy clips all day long, every day. Today, so far, I've watched at least 3 Jim Gaffigan 5-minute clips, 1 Chelsea Peretti clip, 1 Anthony Jeselnik clip. So you just keep immersing yourself.
You said something that was all really useful, actually, but I want to single out one thing, which was that you went back and watched your stuff, which is very hard if you are in learning mode, because it means that you're going to watch yourself perform at a lower level than you'd like to be performing.
Well, you're always, when you watch yourself, even when I watch myself and I think, man, I did great. I can't wait to watch this video. I always watch it and thought, ugh, this is horrible.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I have to, there's so many things I have to like relearn and study. But I started doing this when I was learning chess as a 17-year-old. I would play in a tournament, then I would take all the games I lost and I would bring it a couple towns over. The US chess champion lived, I'd pay him, and I'd say, go over these games with me. And mm-hmm. and we would. And I would study every place where I went wrong.
It requires being okay with not being great. That the pursuit of greatness means that you are not, if you were in pursuit of, it means you are not there yet. And you just have to be okay with that. Ira Glass has this great line, which is that, well, I don't remember it exactly word for word, but he says that when you're starting out on something, there is a great gap between your tastes and your abilities. Just to say, you know what good looks like, and you know that you aren't that. And you just have to be okay with that.
There's two things. You have to be okay with that, but there's also something that's usually used negatively. It's a cognitive bias called the Dunning-Kruger effect, which means you think in the beginning you're better than you actually are. And so for better or for worse, I always had the Dunning-Kruger effect apply to me.
Yeah.
And so that would bridge me long enough to the point where I actually got okay. And it's okay to have the Dunning-Kruger effect if it keeps you going. Like if I thought the first time, like one time in one of the first few times, I bombed so badly and I was heckled so fiercely by the entire audience. Mm. It was just excruciating. And even in the, I went home, I was practically crying. I couldn't sleep at 3 a.m. even. The MC from the show from that day even wrote me an apology note because she ended up, in order to win back the audience, she had to trash me completely as well. And it was just, but you know, I always thought like, I know I'm funny. I know I can do this. But again, humor has little to do with performance and stand-up comedy. And it was excruciating, like some of those first experiences. But I had to fool myself into thinking I can do this. And I still fool myself. I don't know if I'm good or not yet. I still might be having the Dunning-Kruger effect.
Right. But you're having, I mean, and I kind of keep circling back to this just because I want to pin it down, which is having the strength to look very closely at your performance when you know that you're learning is hard, because to go back and watch tape of yourself when you know that you're not as good as you would like to be, and to study it and to say, that was bad to mediocre to fine or whatever. And that's okay because this is data and I'm going to learn from it. And this is the only way forward. Requires a narrative that you tell yourself of progress and of commitment that is hard.
And there's a narrative of this is how you get better. You always get better with looking at yourself doing a skill because then you can analyze. And it even helps if you're looking at it with someone who is better than you and who is giving sincere constructive advice. You got to be careful. You're not looking at it with someone who's going to give destructive advice. I've had that too in every area. Some people don't want you to get better. And even though they're great, they should be confident in themselves. Some people will give you destructive advice. But sometimes I would have a joke and one audience would laugh, one audience wouldn't. And then the audience would seem to me the same kind of type of audience. And so I'd have to look at both videos. What's different between this audience and this audience? Why didn't they laugh this time? Was I doing something different? Was the audience different? You'd have to break apart each word. Was I don't know, it was so complicated. Or in a chess game, you made a wrong move. Well, first off, where did you make the wrong move? What were all of the other possibilities? You have to kind of push yourself to think of all of the other possibilities. And then when you think you've exhausted all the other possibilities, think of 50% more possibilities. Like you just have to really push yourself at each stage. And that's not for comedy or chess or investing in general. That's on each micro skill involved. So just as a quick example, in terms of isolating a micro skill, my daughter, I said to her, why don't you try an open mic? She's 20 years old. I said, why don't you try an open mic? You should try it. And she's like, I have no material. And I said, doesn't matter. Take a good comedian you like, take all of their material and try to perform it. And she says, isn't that stealing? That's unethical.
Sounds like stealing.
Yeah, it's stealing. And normally, joke stealing is the worst crime in stand-up comedy.
Right.
And I said to her, you're doing an open mic. You're not doing a Netflix special. It's not like anybody is going to see this. But this allows you, you know for a fact, the material is good. It was developed by a professional. So now this is one way to isolate just stage presence and delivery. And so you have to come up with ways, safe ways, so you're not accused of stealing or anything like that.
Yeah.
Safe ways to isolate different skills.
Last subject, which is I'm curious where you are now in your work on yourself on stage, because we talked a lot about getting good at the beginning. And there's something, as hard as that can be, it's also easy because you're like, well, I'm a beginner, right? I mean, you cut yourself a lot of slack. But after a number of years of doing something, everybody's still in progress. Everybody's a work in progress. So let's just sort of caveat that. To look at yourself now and see flaws could be, I imagine, harder. Because at this point, you might feel like, I should have that down by now. I should be better than that. I shouldn't have to go through this process. I think that with my, you know, I did this thing on Cheddar because I was brand new to this idea. Now that I've been doing it for a number of years, actually, the moments in which I flub on TV, I'm harder on myself for it now than I was back then. Because back then I was like, I'm a beginner, I'm learning, it's fine. Now I feel like I put in a lot of work, I should have this down. When I stumble, I feel like something is genuinely wrong. I wonder how you work through that.
It's very hard. I am really hard on myself where on days, and again, the days where I totally bomb are much fewer. I haven't been heckled, for instance, in a year or so. So fortunately, and whereas it was a regular occurrence when I was beginning, but I am particularly hard on myself, particularly when I look at the video and I'm like, why am I still doing that hunched forward thing? Or why did I have those extra words that I didn't need in that joke? I knew I didn't need them. Why did I say that right there or that, or, you know, why didn't I pause a little bit more? That would have just another second pause or microsecond pause would have made that joke funnier. Mm. So I am really hard on myself. And I don't think you ever finish learning a skill. Any skill worth learning, you never finish learning it. Like you stop at the level you want. Like at chess, I stopped at the level I was satisfied with, but I could always have kept going and gotten better. Same thing with entrepreneurship, investing, writing, and so on. But now I would say, I think in terms of, you asked specifically about stage presence, I think I could do better with my voice, do more modulating or acting out with my voice. I could use the stage more purposefully. I think I don't like it when a comedian just stands there at a mic and tells jokes. I feel the stage is there
unless
for a reason.
Unless that's their shtick.
Yeah, unless that's their shtick. Unless there's a reason.
There should always be a reason
for everything you do. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with most skills. Like with writing, there should be a reason for every single word.
Right.
There should be a reason why, like Hemingway is known for his minimalism. Like he has these short sentences that are usually one syllables each word. But That should have a reason. That should belong in the story, why he's doing that.
It's an economy of language.
Right. And the reason why in The Old Man and the Sea, that's to an extreme, is because it's told from the point of view of an old man who's been fishing all his life. He's not going to say big syllable words. So the structure of the story should be part of the story itself. Same thing with comedy. Everything you do should be part of the overall comedic effect you're trying to create. It should be part of the story. So I think I need to work on that a little bit more. Like, you see with Dave Chappelle, the difference between his voice on stage and his voice in real life. He infuses energy and comedy in every single word of his voice. He has like a comedic accent almost. Mm-hmm. And he's moving around in very specific, sharp ways. Or why do you think, you ever watch Chris Rock? He walks back and forth on the stage really fast while he's talking. There's a reason for that. It's because if you close your eyes and you open them, you won't see him. So people pay attention more mm-hmm. to Chris Rock. And he does that on purpose. So there's a reason for everything with the greatest comedians. And so I want to learn more about stage presence and how to, and with public speaking, by the way, that's not true. You don't have to do that in public speaking. The bar is much lower in terms of stage presence on public speaking.
But if you can become a really, really good public speaker, the audience appreciates it more. Like I've seen terrible talks at conferences, and I've seen people who just like blow it away. There is the space for the people who blow it away. It's just that the bar is lower and that they'll let you on stage with bad stage presence. But that doesn't mean that you should pass with that.
Right. And I would say that's one of the direct benefits of stand-up comedy is that it's made me a better public speaker because it adds to almost every aspect of the things that are important in public speaking, and including saying, you know, an important skill we didn't talk about in comedy is you have to say something interesting. As opposed to a knock-knock joke, which is not really interesting, even though it might be funny, with stand-up comedy, you have to say it's more important to be interesting than to be funny in many cases. Same thing with public speaking, but it helps to be funny.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's...
I feel like every interview that's about stand-up comedy with somebody who does stand-up comedy has to end with, and they can catch you at... But this is an evergreen podcast, so there's no way to say dates. But where are you usually performing?
Well, I've been fortunate also in that I feel like I've gotten to a point where other comedy clubs are starting to ask me more and more to perform there. So basically most places around town, but I happen to be a part owner of Stand Up New York, and it's across the street from where I live. So I perform a lot there, which is on 78th and Broadway in New York City. And you could check the schedule to see where I'm on. I usually don't promote it because usually I'm trying to, at any particular performance, I'm usually trying to isolate some skill and work on it. So I don't necessarily always want people to see me. Adults don't like to watch other adults trying things. So when I'm trying things, I don't necessarily like to have a great audience.
Right.
And sometimes that's I specifically really challenge myself. Sometimes I specifically want the worst possible spot of the night in the worst week of the night, just to keep challenging myself in that respect too. It's a way of isolating the skill of how do you deal with a horrible audience.
I love that. I mean, there's the takeaway, which is continue to challenge yourself.
Yeah, find the different ways to challenge yourself. Divide it into micro skills. Find your plus, minus, equal, and find always immerse yourself every day and find different ways to challenge yourself seems to be. And I will add one more thing. Try, even though it's hard to quantify, try to be 1% better every day because that compounds very quickly. And it's amazing how fast that compounds, even if it's hard to quantify.
Well, James, I look forward to catching you on stage on a night in which you're not trying stuff and you're at the end of the night and you're hiding from me.
Thanks so much, Jason. It's been a pleasure coming on this podcast. I'm really glad you asked me on.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to Problem Solvers wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Monday morning and you don't want to miss it. And hey, be kind. Pass the show along to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost. And did you solve a problem that would be good for this show? Let me know about it. Visit my website, jasonfeifer.com, JasonFeifer.com, where you can find my contact information and all sorts of other valuable info. Problem Solvers is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for all your entrepreneurship needs. And even better, subscribe to our magazine, which is just full of the smartest entrepreneurs solving the toughest problems. My name is Jason Feifer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. Thanks for listening. And hey, let's go solve some problems.